I read an article in The Guardian. It was titled this, "The Age of Envy, How to Be Happy When Everyone Else's Life Looks Perfect." And the author of the article said that envy is increasing thanks to social media. Now, not only do we compare ourselves to friends and family and neighbors, as we've always done, even before social media, but now, thanks to social media, we compare ourselves to friends of friends, to people across the globe, to celebrities, to strangers even. And the article calls this comparisonitis, comparisonitis. And we all have that to some extent. Quoting one psychology professor, "We are constantly bombarded by photoshopped lives, and that exerts a toll on us, the likes of which we have never experienced in the history of our species." And then the article concludes, "While we are busy finding the perfect camera angle, our lives become a dazzling, flawless but hard shell, empty inside, but for the envy of others and ourselves." Now, in a different article, a Harvard professor wrote this, wrote something similar. He said, "A former student of mine who graduated 10 years ago and has a terrific job in a Fortune 500 company, at least it seems like a terrific job, until she received her alumni newsletter and learned that her fellow alumnus, who was an MBA program graduate like herself, had just been named the VP of a Fortune 100 company. And from that moment on, she could barely hold a conversation without bemoaning her lack of VP and Fortune 100 company status. On more than one occasion, she told others she felt like a failure." And I think, again, to some extent, we all struggle with this as we compare ourselves with other people. I remember when I was near graduating from seminary, and my wife was 8.5 months pregnant, and I didn't have a job for the entire semester. Last semester, I applied to job after job after job, and no one wanted to hire poor Kyle. And so my wife was about to have a baby, so I went back to my previous job in secular work at the hospital. And I continued to look for jobs as I was working there. And I heard time after time, people I graduated with in seminary get good jobs, good church jobs, jobs that I was not getting. And I remember one night as I was walking with my wife out in the neighborhood, and I said to her, no one wants to hire me. And yet so-and-so just became a senior pastor right out of seminary. And so-and-so got a good job at a good church. And yet me, on the other hand, I got nothing. I got nothing. And so if I'm being honest, I was jealous of them. I wanted that. I was comparing my life to theirs. In our psalm today, in Psalm 73, we're going to see the comparison game play out for the psalmist as well. But this time, we're going to see the psalmist is going to realize as he gets into the psalm that not everything is as it seems. And so he's going to return to the idea that even though it seems better out there, it's actually far better to be close to God. So let's go ahead and take a look at our message. So Psalm 73 was written by Asaph. Asaph was a person who worked with King David. He was essentially a worship leader. And so we'll call him the worship leader of the tabernacle choir. And in Psalm 73, verse 1, he says, "Truly God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." And so this is his introductory paragraph here. And he mentions a time where he almost stumbled. He's not talking literally as if he was walking and just tripped like that. He's talking spiritually, where he almost spiritually slipped. What caused this? Why did he have almost big time spiritual problems in his life? He says in verse 3, he was envious of the arrogant. Now, we don't know a lot of details about who the arrogant are, but we are going to see that these people are people who do not know God yet are prospering in some way. So if we were to put this in modern day American context, let's say I'm writing this. And so in America, it would be as if the neighbors down the street who do not know God, they have that coexist bumper sticker on the back of their car. And it's a very expensive car. It's like a Mercedes or a Tesla or something. And so they're prospering and they have a boat that they go out to the lake every Sunday morning instead of going to church. And they have the nice house and they have all this nice stuff. And you look at them and they're like, wait a second. They don't know God. In fact, when I invited them to church last week, they laughed at me. They don't know God yet. They are prospering. And then you look at your own life and you see all the struggles that you're having. And you're like, wait a second. This is not how it's supposed to be, right? I follow God, so I'm supposed to have the better life. And maybe you're not just envious of someone financially. Maybe you're envious because they have the better job than you. Or maybe you're envious because they do not struggle with infertility like you do. Or maybe you're envious because they have a smoking hot spouse and you do not. Whatever it may be, you are envious of them. And you're like, hey, what about me, God? What about me? And that's what Asaph is saying in this first part here. And so what we need to see is that comparing can be dangerous. Comparing can be dangerous. Now, I'm glad that Asaph is being honest here, but we also need to see that when we start comparing our lives to each other and our lives to other people, and when we start envying what they have, it could lead us to stumble spiritually, just like it almost did for Asaph. And in verses 4 to 15, we see a description of what Asaph saw in these people. And so I'm going to go over a few of these descriptions of these people. For example, in verse 4, he says, "For they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek." And that's not making fun of them. He's saying, hey, they never seem to get sick. In fact, they're fat. In that time, being fat was a good thing. That meant that they were prosperous. That meant that they had enough resources to sit around and consume instead of having to work. Verse 12 says, "Behold, they are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches." And so these people are rich and prosperous. Verse 5, "They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind." And so they always seem to get away with things, Asaph is noticing. This is a common complaint in my house. My kids are constantly saying things like, "You never punish so-and-so. You don't love me. You love him more." And so that's what Asaph is saying here. If my kids had written this out thousands of years ago, they may have ended up in scripture, because I constantly hear, hey, how come I get in trouble for this, but they don't? Now, since they never seem to get in trouble, these people are starting to get arrogant. Verse 6, "Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment." Skipping to verse 8, "They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression." Now, sadly, because of this pride that creeps into their life, they say the same to God and act pridefully towards God as well. In verse 9, "They set their mouths against the heavens and their tongues strut through the earth." Verse 11, "And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High. And so not only are they acting wickedly, but they're mocking God in the meantime while they're doing it. And so these are the people that Asaph is comparing his life to. And two issues arise that I want to point out as he's comparing his life to. And so in verse 13, we see that comparing leads to feeling like you're missing out. You're missing out. Asaph notices all this and he sees the wickedness, and then he also sees their prosperity, and he's like, hey, well, what about me? Why did I do all of this? Verse 13, he says, all in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. So he's saying that he did all the right things, and yet it didn't work out for him. And so what he did in a pure way, in a right way, in a righteous way, must be in vain. They have the better toys. I do not. And so God must like them more than me. Now listen, this is important for us to see, that becoming a Christian does not mean life will be better from a human perspective. In fact, Jesus says so in John chapter 16. He says, in this world, you will have an awesome time. Wait. No, he says, in this world, you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. So Jesus is essentially saying here, hey, I've won. I'm in charge. But you folks, you're going to have some tribulation here in this world. And so if we go to Christianity as a way just to end all of our problems, we are setting ourselves up for letdown at some point in the future. I remember years ago, someone started attending this church who was a new Christian, and life was going really well for him for a little while. But then some difficulties, some challenges came into his life, partially by his own doing, and partially just with bad circumstances and what, you know, he would consider bad luck. And when he encountered these difficulties, he got mad at God and stopped coming to church. And after time, I heard it was because he realized that life went better for him before he went to church than when he did. And so he stopped going to church. He stopped following God because life was better before. Again, we need to keep an eye on this, that if we are going to Jesus just because we think that he's going to end all of our difficulties, then we are setting ourselves up for letdown. It's so important that as Christians that we have an eternal perspective. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on this. I've talked about this before. Life may get tough here. In fact, it will get tough here. But that doesn't mean that God doesn't love us. And doesn't mean that he's not in charge. Thanks to Jesus dying, thanks to him overcoming the world, those who put their faith in him may encounter difficulties, but because of our faith in Jesus, we can put our hope not in this world, but in the world, in the future that Jesus is going to make for us. And so, life may be difficult now. You may have health problems. In fact, I'll dare say, every one of you will have health problems at some point. In fact, here, let me let you in on a little secret. Unless Jesus returns, every one of us are going to die of health problems. God, why would you let that happen to me? Well, because this world is not our home. We're just passing through it. We're just passing through it. And as we're going through it, we're on mission for him. We're sharing others about the good news, sharing with others about the good news of Jesus. But one day, he's going to bring us home. And that's where we can bank on it getting a lot better. So we need to remember, just because we put our faith in Jesus Christ right now doesn't mean it's going to all of a sudden get better. Here's the second thing that we see about comparing. Not only does it lead to feeling like you're missing out, but comparing leads to a negative attitude towards God. A negative attitude. Verse 14, for all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. Now, in the moment, we're going to see that he actually was not stricken. But in the moment, while he was comparing himself to others, he felt like he was. So this led to negative attitudes that he's giving to God because of this comparing that he's doing. He felt rebuked by God. He felt stricken by God when in fact he wasn't. Now, can we all agree here that comparing ourselves to the world, comparing ourselves to other people and envying what they have can lead to trouble? Can we all agree that? This leads to a very important question, though. How do we avoid the trap of comparing? How do we avoid the trap of comparing? Asaph gives us some thought, and this is what he did to avoid the trap of comparing. Verse 16. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. And so Asaph, he saw everything, he looked at everything, and he envied some, but then he finally realized that he couldn't continue going in that direction. And so he says he went to the sanctuary of God. What he means is that instead of looking outward, he looked upward. He looked upward. And so he stopped comparing himself to the ungodly, and he started focusing instead on what God is and what God says. In other words, he put on what I might call God-centric glasses. Those of you who wear glasses or contacts, you get this. Every morning, we get up, and the world is a little bit blurry, isn't it? For some of you, it's a lot blurry. And you go around, and finally, you put on your contacts, you put on your glasses, and there, for the first time, you can see things. They're clear for the first time. Now, spiritually speaking, we need to do the same like this. The world looks different when we don't have our God-centric glasses on. By the way, I have my contacts on, so I'm not going to wear these much. But in our blurry vision, without our glasses, without our God-centric glasses, we're going to mistake something that's bad as something that might be good. Sometimes I joke with my kids when I take my glasses off and they know I can't see, and one of them will come up, like Josiah will come up to me, and he'll ask me something, and I'll say, "No, Paul, you can't have that." And they get a kick out of it. Julia says, hey, can I have this? And I'm like, "No, Grace, no. Where are you? Where'd you go?" Now, that's all in jest, but we often do this spiritually in our own lives without even realizing it. When we look around at the world, we say things like, that family doesn't know God, but they seem to have it all. They have the nice job. They have the good life. But when we put on the God-centric glasses, we will start to see things for how they really are. I came across a YouTube video of people who would inspect hotel rooms with UV lights. And they would go into these nice-looking rooms and turn off the lights and then turn on the UV light, and they would see stains everywhere. Everywhere. Bodily fluids on every surface. Now listen, life may seem good for the people that you are envying, but if they don't have God in their life, they are looking like a nice hotel room that is full of unseen stains. Now in the next part, he examines how things truly are. How things truly are. And when he looks through, or when he looks at things with his God-centric glasses, he sees things in the real way, how they truly are. And he starts by looking at what life is like for those who do not follow God. In verses 18 through 22, we see that those who don't follow God have a bleak future. Verse 18, "Truly you set them in a slippery place. You make them fall to ruin. how they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. One pastor wrote in a commentary about this. He said, it's as if he was looking at a fat cow enjoying a meal on its way to the slaughter. Despite his earlier evaluation, the psalmist realizes he doesn't want to head in the same direction as the wicked. And so the cow there may be super happy, mooing his way, enjoying the grass, enjoying his meal, happy as can be, not realizing that in a moment, he's going to get a big bop on the head and his life's going to be over. That is what Asaph sees is coming for the wicked, for those who do not follow God. They may seem happy. They may seem to have it all, but that will come crashing down one day. There was an article in Christianity Today from a while back about a farmer from the Midwest many, many years ago who had a strong dislike for religious people. And so on Sunday morning, he was plowing his fields, and every time a Christian would walk by on their way to church, he would shake their fists at them. And October came, and the farmer that was doing this had his best crop ever. In fact, it was the best crop in the entire county. And after the harvest, he took out an advertisement in the local newspaper to make fun of the Christians. And at the end of the article, he said, faith in God must not mean much if someone like me can prosper. Well, in the next edition of the town paper, Christians from the community responded by placing their own ad. And they wrote very simply, God doesn't always settle his accounts in October. Now, next, we're going to see here that in the long run, life is far better for those who follow God. Verse 23, nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterward, you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is my strength of my heart. God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. I talked about how I worked as a social worker in a hospital. Well, part of that was working with sick people, go figure. And sometimes I'd work with super sick people, people that were near death. And let me tell you, when I worked with the people where death was imminent, they had the better perspective of life than people who were not near death. Not once did anyone tell me as they were near death, I am so glad I have that big bank account. Not once. Not once did anyone tell me, I know I'm about to die today, but you should go and see my car in my driveway. Never did anyone say that. You see, when death is near, you don't think about the things that ultimately don't matter. And through God-centric glasses, Asaph came to the same realization, but thankfully before he was dying. And so he says, hey, my heart and my flesh may fail, but my God will not. And so he says, hey, I'm sticking with God. It looks nice out there, but I'm sticking with the one who's going to last longer than all these nice things. Everything else is eventually going to fade. Everything else is eventually going to be meaningless, as Solomon talked about in Ecclesiastes, except for one thing. Do you follow the one who is eternal? Do you follow the one who is eternal? Only he will stick with you, as Asaph says. He will hold your right hand. Only he will guide you. Only he is the one who knows how to conquer death. Now, Asaph, who was many, many years before Jesus came, had part of the picture, part of the God-centric glasses. But now we have what I might call God-centric glasses 2.0. We have a better perspective on things because Asaph knew about God. He knew probably about a coming Messiah. But now we know that God loved us so much that he sent his only son, Jesus, to die for us. And so now whoever believes in him might have eternal life. And so now anyone who believes in him is saved from death. And that's where we should put all of our trust in. And this leads us to the very last two verses of the passage where we see that we all have to make a choice. We all are going to have to make a choice. Verse 27, "For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near to God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell of all your works." And so again, Asaph saw all the people prospering. And he saw the wicked getting all the good things. But he then saw the futility of it. And he saw that God was the better option. And so he concluded, hey, I'm putting all my eggs in God's basket. I'm sticking with him. And so I want to ask you, Asaph decided that. What are you going to decide? What are you going to decide? If you've never put your faith in Jesus Christ, then it starts with that. By praying, just very simply, Lord, I believe you're Lord. Will you come? Will you come into my life? Forgive me of my sins. And you just pray something like that and mean it with your heart. Then you will be saved. And that's the first step in being part. And that's what you do to be part of his family. But some of you may have done that in the past, but you've drifted away. Maybe you've started envying a little bit too much, and that's caused you to walk further and further away from God. And I want to encourage you today that as we wrap up this message and as we sing a song in a moment, hey, let's just spend a moment of prayer with him and say, God, I've asked you into my life before. I've made you God, but I've drifted, and so help me now. Help me now to come back to you. God, help me not to compare with all these other things. Help me to put my faith and trust in you completely. On October 25th, 1859, the steam clipper Royal Charter was near the coast of Wales at the end of a two-month journey from Australia to Liverpool. There were 500 people on board, and many were ecstatic from their success in Australia's gold fields. So many passengers had gold crammed in their luggage and crammed in their pockets and crammed in their money belts and crammed everywhere you could think just to keep it safe on their journey back to England. On the last day of the journey, a storm approached, and for 12 hours, the ship battled the storm, but the battle ended when the ship bashed into some rocks, sinking it. Only 41 passengers survived out of the 500. It's believed that many drowned because they were weighted down by the gold in their pockets. I want to ask you, are you living like someone on that ship? Someone that's been thrown into the water, that's sinking into the water right now with gold, rich as can be, but about to die, headed towards death, weighted down by things that don't ultimately matter? Or are you comparing yourself to them, envying what they have, wishing you had their fortune, not taking into account their fate? So I want to encourage us again. Let's turn to God. Turn to God. Let's put on our God-centric glasses and let's see things for the way they truly are. Let's go ahead and spend a moment now in prayer. I'm going to ask the worship team to come on up.